The night shift at Belford Industrial Complex was never busy, but it wasn't supposed to be disturbing either. Nathan Heller, a former cop turned security guard, had been pacing the same halls for over a year now. Big building, cold halls, faint smell of rust in the air. Cameras covered every corner, but he still insisted on walking the perimeter twice a night. Old habits. Plus, the flashlight in his hand made him feel like he was still doing something that mattered. His boots clicked against the concrete as he made his way past the loading bay, then along the southern corridor where the fuse boxes hummed softly. Nothing new. A flicker of light from his flashlight revealed dust on the doorknobs and dead bugs near the vents. Routine stuff. He stopped near the northern end of the building and looked up. The attic window, the only window on the rooftop, sat still, as always. But just as he turned to move, he saw it. A flicker. Quick, weak, but real. He stared. Maybe it was the reflection from his flashlight. Maybe it was nothing. He kept looking. Nothing. He shook his head and continued his round. 10 minutes later, he found himself back at the same spot. This time, the light came again. Not a flicker, a steady, warm orange glow. What the hell? He turned off his flashlight and waited in the dark. The glow vanished. He didn't call it in. He had no one to call. The only other guard quit 2 weeks ago, and the company hadn't replaced him yet. Cheap bastards. Sighing, he moved toward the stairs that led up to the attic. He climbed slowly, each metal step creaking beneath him. The air grew colder as he ascended, like the building itself didn't want him up there. He reached the attic door. It was smaller than most, more like a crawlspace entrance. A faint light glowed underneath it. He reached for his baton. "Let's not make this a thing," he muttered, and nudged the door open. The attic was cramped. The ceiling sloped sharply, forcing him to crouch. A mattress lay in the center, torn, stained, disgusting. Next to it, a pile of small blue booklets. Notebooks, maybe. One had something scrawled on the cover in red ink. "They watch from below." Nathan swept the light around. A rusted table beneath the window held a dim orange lamp, food wrappers, crusty mugs. One still had steam rising from it. Then he saw it. A pool of blood, fresh and glistening beside the mattress. Jesus Christ. He stepped closer, heart racing. His fingers itched to call 911, but he didn't move. And that's when he heard the soft click behind him. The attic door. Footsteps. Then a voice. Calm. Male. With a twist of something off kilter. "Welcome to my humble abode. Tea?" Nathan spun around. A man in an ill-fitting suit leaned against the closed door. Young. Maybe early 30s, with shaggy dark hair and eyes that didn't blink. "Who the hell are you?" The man grinned.
"You can call me Andrew."
"That's not my name, but it'll do for tonight." Nathan raised his baton. "Step aside." Andrew didn't move.
"They told me you'd come."
"Who?"
"The people in the booklets. They watch. They know."
Nathan inched forward. "You're bleeding?"
"No. That's not mine."
Nathan didn't believe him, but his focus darted back to the pool of blood. It hadn't moved. Still fresh. "You living up here?"
"That's a stretch. More like hiding."
"From what?" Andrew's smile widened.
"You ever read about mind control experiments from the 70s? Belford used to be a research site, military funded, before it became your quiet little warehouse."
Nathan felt a headache forming. "Cut the crap. Who's bleeding?" Andrew's gaze drifted to the window.
"Would you believe me if I said I'm trying to protect you?"
"Not remotely," Andrew sighed.
"They'll be here soon. They don't like when the attic light's on. It means I remember."
Suddenly, a dull thud echoed from below. Then another. Rhythmic. Heavy. Nathan flinched. "What's that?" Andrew's tone changed.
"You waited too long. You were supposed to leave."
Nathan moved toward the door. Andrew stepped aside.
"Run if you like, but it won't help."
Nathan bolted down the stairs. Something buzzed from the fuse box, like static in the air. He made it to the security station and grabbed the landline. Dead. He reached for his phone. No signal. The thuds were louder now. Not footsteps, not machinery. They were inside the walls. Nathan remembered the booklets. He rushed back up, shoved the attic door open. Empty. No Andrew. No blood. Just the notebooks. He grabbed the one that said, "They watch from below," and flipped through it. Drawings. Crude, paranoid sketches. Eyes. Tunnels. Creatures with wires for limbs. Words repeated over and over. "Don't sleep in the building. Don't stay past midnight. Don't turn on the attic light." Then, in newer ink, one line. "The guard is the final piece." Behind him, the door closed again. A whisper. "Now they can come." He turned. Andrew stood with something in his hand. Metal, surgical, sharp. Nathan raised his baton, but it was too late. Andrew lunged, driving the object into his gut. Nathan fell back.
"It was never about you,"
Andrew whispered.
"You're just the gatekeeper."
Nathan's vision blurred. He looked toward the window. Outside, shadows moved. Tall, thin, impossibly fast.
"You opened the attic,"
Andrew said.
"That's the trigger."
As Nathan faded, Andrew picked up the booklet and placed it neatly on the table beside the mug.
"Ah, tea's cold now. Pity."
He turned to the window.
"He's ready. Come in."
From outside, something hissed. The light went out. The attic window turned crimson. The next morning, no one found a body. In the real-world scenario, in the year 2024, a Michigan woman was found living in a rooftop sign above a grocery store. Contractors discovered her living situation while working on the Family Fair store. The 34-year-old woman reportedly had a mini-desk, flooring, food, and a houseplant inside the sign.
"My name is Claire Whitmore, and I was once the personal maid, and eventually the only true companion, of Mary. The year was 1886 when I first met her. I was just 23, a widow myself, eager for work and not one to ask questions. The agency said she was generous with her pay, quiet, and a little strange since her husband's death. None of that deterred me, though. I needed the job. The Winchester mansion was still small then, though even then, its angles were peculiar. The front door led to a narrow hallway with five different turns. A staircase stopped at the ceiling. But the air was heavy, like someone was always watching. I chalked it up to the grief of the household. Mary was elegant, distant. She moved through the halls like she belonged to another time, always dressed in black. Her eyes were alert, haunted. She barely spoke to the others. But for some reason, she took to me.
"Clara, do you believe in spirits?"
she asked me one night as I served her tea in her study. It was one of those rare moments she looked directly into my eyes. I hesitated. "I believe grief makes us see things."
"That's what they all say,"
she whispered. Then she turned her gaze back to the window.
"But they're wrong."
Soon, she began inviting me to her nightly walks around the mansion. Every evening, after the workers left, she would inspect each newly built hallway, touch every doorknob, count each step of every staircase. She changed the plans often, without warning. Sometimes she'd order a corridor sealed behind bricks. Other times she'd demand that a door be moved 3 feet to the left. At first, I thought she was crazy. Then, I heard the knocking. Late at night, always between 2 and 3, soft knocks echoed from behind the walls. No pattern, no footsteps, just knocks. Once I asked her about it.
"They're trying to find me," she said. "But they won't, not if I keep changing the layout."
I wanted to leave, and God knows I tried, but something pulled me back. Some form of empathy, I guess. Or fear. I didn't have any family left. Nowhere to go. Things changed when he arrived. the medium. His name was Jonathan Vale. Young, charming, with eyes too calm for a man who claimed to speak to the dead. She invited him into the heart of her paranoia like he was a savior. I was there during the first seance. I didn't believe in it, not truly, but she insisted I stay. "Mary, your husband is here," he said, eyes closed, fingers laced. Her fingers gripped the table. "He says those killed by the Winchester rifles want peace, but they have none. You need to build them a sanctuary. Only then will they leave you be." Mary nodded, tears in her eyes. She believed every word. And the construction doubled, tripled, dozens of workers hired, then let go. Halls built and destroyed within days. I watched her wither as the mansion grew. But the knockings grew louder. One night, I followed a sound to a disused wing. The air was freezing even though it was summer. The door opened to a brick wall. I turned, and there she was.
"You shouldn't be here,"
she hissed. Her voice was unfamiliar, like it belonged to someone else entirely. I backed away.
"Mary, what's happening? You need to rest. You need to stop building."
Her eyes burned into mine.
"They told me you would say that."
She stopped trusting me after that. Jonathan became her shadow, whispering in her ear, leading her down darker paths. Then, one day, I found blueprints hidden in a drawer. They weren't for construction. They were diagrams, symbols, circles, strange runes. Not English, not anything I'd seen. I confronted Jonathan. He was in the garden smoking. He smiled when he saw me.
"She trusts me, you know."
"You're manipulating her." He raised an eyebrow.
"Am I? Or am I protecting her?"
I stepped closer. "What do you want?"
"The house, Clara. Don't be so naive. The land, the money, the legacy. Once she's gone, it's all mine."
It was then I realized he never spoke to the dead. He played on her pain, her madness. But it wasn't all lies. That night, I woke up to a scream. Mary's voice echoed through the halls. I ran into her room and found her on the floor, pale, drenched in sweat.
"They're inside. He let them in."
I took her hand. "We have to get you out of here."
"No," she said. "You don't understand. It's not just the house anymore. They're in him."
She refused to eat, refused to sleep. Jonathan stayed away those last days, claiming she needed solitude. One morning, I awoke to silence. The knocks had stopped. I searched her mansion. Her room was empty, the bed untouched. We never found her. The police said she'd gone mad, wandered off, perhaps fallen into one of the many sealed wings of the mansion. But I knew better. I confronted Jonathan for the last time. He was packing, eager to claim the estate. I told him what I saw, what I knew. He laughed.
"You think I killed her, Clara? She built her own tomb. I just gave her the bricks."
He inherited nothing. Turns out she had rewritten her will weeks before, donating everything to a preservation trust. The house could never be sold, only studied. Jonathan disappeared soon after. Rumors said he was found dead in a hotel room in Sacramento, eyes wide open, mouth twisted in terror. I left the mansion that day and never returned. Years later, I saw tourists flocking to the Winchester Mystery House. They marveled at its oddities, its staircases to nowhere, its doors to nothing. They called it eccentric, an architectural wonder. But I knew the truth. Mary didn't build a house. She built a prison. And some things inside never left. I still hear the knocking sometimes. Even now, in my sleep. In 1886, Sarah Winchester, widow of gun magnate William Winchester, moved to San Jose, California, and began building what would become the Winchester Mystery House. Haunted by grief and convinced that spirits of those killed by Winchester rifles sought vengeance, she constructed a mansion without end. For 38 years, workers built day and night, creating staircases to nowhere, hidden rooms, and endless hallways to confuse vengeful ghosts. When Sarah died in 1922, construction halted instantly. The house, with its eerie design and over 160 rooms, became a legend. To this day, visitors report ghostly whispers and shadowy figures, keeping alive the chilling mystery of Sarah Winchester's lifelong obsession.
I was never big into babysitting. From time to time, I could pick up a job to help a friend, or if one of my mom's friends couldn't find a sitter. As the youngest in my family, I never experienced caring for those younger than me, so babysitting always felt outside my scope of capabilities. I have a hard time knowing how to control kids. It's just, I never learned how to punish or handle kids appropriately. Not that I was doing or wanting anything inappropriate, but I always feared I'd do something wrong, and the parent would come home outraged that I put their kid in their room for 20 minutes. Like, what do you do when two thin boys pull their pants down and start peeing on each other in the middle of the living room, spraying all the expensive suede furniture? Better babysitters have an answer. I, on the other hand, stood in horror, shielding my eyes as I begged them to stop. They didn't, and I didn't take another babysitting job until my mom told me about this couple at their church that was desperate for a sitter. They offered me $150 for a night, which was astronomical back in the day. I didn't even think to ask why they were desperate. The kid's mom made it sound like an easy gig. One kid, 10 years old, get there at 5:30 p.m. and his bedtime was 8:30 p.m. and she said they would get back around 11 to midnight. 3 hours watching TV with a kid for $150? Absolutely, sign me up. They lived in a baby blue two-story home with white wood details on the windows. I knocked on the white door, and the boy's mom opened the door wearing a flattering maroon-wrapped dress. She was beautiful. My mom mentioned how stunning and young she looked for her age. Frankly, my mom didn't do this woman justice. She could have been a supermodel with her long auburn hair and mahogany eyes. Her name was Trish, and she insisted I call her by her first name. She invited me in. Trish had flawlessly decorated her home. It was the perfect balance of cozy with plush carpets and taste with sleek leather furniture. "Thank you so much for doing this. You have no idea how hard it can be to find a sitter," she told me. She turned to yell up the stairs. "Charles, come meet your sitter, Lexi." A young boy descended the stairs. The energy of the room grew grim with each step he took. He got his hair and eye color from his mother. His hair was perfectly parted on the side like he was a little man going to work at a bank. Charles' choice of clothing contributed to his small man persona. He wore an Argyle sweater vest over a white button-up with trousers. Charles did not strike me as a typical 10-year-old. "Charles, this is Lexi." He looked up at me with a straight face. His mom continued, "Say hi, Charles, please." Charles ignored his mother's pleas and nodded at me. "Hi, Charles. I'm Lexi. Is it cool if I hang out with you tonight?" I wanted it to seem like I knew what I was doing for his mom's sake, but it didn't seem Charles registered what I said. "Please, Charles," Trish urged her son. He maintained his stoic aura. Trish's husband came around the corner holding a tiny tuxedo kitten. The kitten looked to be about 5 to 6 months old. He had white mittens and a white tip on his tail. When her husband eyed Charles standing in the foyer with us, he hesitated before coming closer. Trish nodded at him to encourage him to join us. He was equally as handsome as his wife. He wore glasses and dressed the same as his son. "Oh yes, can you also feed Mr. Tingles?" Trish asked. I love cats, so I was ecstatic to hang out with the kitten after the boy went to bed. Charles seemed indifferent towards the cat, rolling his eyes at his mother's evident excitement over Mr. Tingles. Before Trish left, she told me to call her if there were any issues, any at all. She would have her phone on her the entire time. After his parents left, Charles didn't speak. He stared at me the entire time, I tried to talk to him, but Charles wouldn't respond. He would just sit there like a ventriloquist dummy with a frown. I thought he might be excited about Mr. Tingles, but his frown grew more profound when I asked him about the cat. Complaining about a quiet kid feels weird, but something about Charles made my skin crawl. We sat down to eat our Kraft mac and cheese. Lexi? He broke the silence. Yes? If I put enough pressure, could I pierce your hand with my fork? Yeah, probably. Why? Charles shrugged and stabbed his mac and cheese to pick it up while keeping eye contact with me. What the hell? After dinner, I asked if he wanted to watch a movie. He didn't say anything, so I put one on because I was getting weirded out by the silence. We sat and watched a TV show his mom mentioned he liked. I tried to make time move faster until the kid needed to go to bed. His bedtime finally rolled around, and without saying anything, he got up from his spot on the couch and went up to the stairs to get ready for bed, taking the kitten with him. I told him I would clean up dinner and meet him up there to say goodnight. Of course, he wouldn't respond. As expected, he made no noise as he got ready for bed. He cleaned up the kitchen and went upstairs to check on him. He wasn't in the bedroom, so I walked around to his room, and he was lying on his stomach, reading a book in bed on his pillow. His elbows were propped up on the pillow, holding it down. Hey Charles, just checking to see how you're doing, or if you need anything? No response. Okay, cool. Before I turned to go back downstairs to leave the boy to his book, I realized I didn't see Mr. Tingles. Charles, where's Mr. Tingles? Does he sleep with you? I asked, hoping he would say no so I could cuddle with him after Charles went to bed. He didn't say anything and continued to read his book. As I turned around to walk away, I heard a weak and muffled meow. I turned to Charles and saw a small white-tipped tail whipping around from under the pillow, but I couldn't see Mr. Tingles' head. Charles, where's Mr. Tingles? No response. Charles, please answer me. Where is Mr. Tingles? He ignored me and continued to read. I could see the cat's tail peeking out from under the pillow, so I knew he had the cat fully under the pillow. Did he know that would suffocate the cat? I think he's under your pillow. You need to let him go. He can't breathe. No. He finally spoke. Charles. No. No. No! He started throwing a tantrum as I pleaded for him to release the cat. Mr. Tingles would suffocate, so with time running out and no other choice, I ran and picked Charles up to release the cat. Mr. Tingles bolted out of the room once he was released from Charles. I couldn't believe what had just taken place. Charles knew what he was doing, and he wanted to kill Mr. Tingles. I wasn't sure how to react, so I made him go to bed then and there and locked him in his room. I found Mr. Tingles, who hid from me the rest of the night. When his parents arrived home, I explained what happened, and Trish burst into tears. Apparently, he killed their last cat, the cat Trish had for 13 years, by putting it in the dryer. Trish recently got Mr. Tingles, hoping it was a one-time thing. Then, I understood why they had difficulty finding and keeping a sitter. I didn't babysit for them or anyone else again.